Hello.
Hello.
Thank you. I am really excited to be here and to introduce you to Laurel Lathrop. And maybe introduce isn't the right word exactly, because I'm looking at you and I think most of you know this woman. She's brilliant. She's funny as hell. She makes a mean batch of white chocolate and ginger cookies from her own recipe. And if you've ever had the good fortune to be in a workshop with her, you know she's got the keenest of eyes, and she's the most generous reader. And small detail, she's a freaking scary talented writer. Evidence. This is an excerpt from a story called Cunning that was chosen for publication by the one and only Kelly Link. Here's Laurel. Now the witch leaned in close and whispered certain things I cannot tell. A charm to send a fat dove hopping to one's hand. Powerful enchantments of the sight that can be done with the bones of a cat or a rabbit. The name of the flower, which when drunk in wine brings forth dead fruit from the womb. She drew her long finger on the girl's palm, the symbol which, traced in salt on a threshold, draws down a 9-times curse on an enemy. The girl heard these things and knew that they were true and wanted to know more. And my father, she asked. The witch did not reply, only looked at her with her eyes the color of melted gold. Okay, first of all, witches. But it's not just the content that's so enchanting, it's the prose, it's musical, seductive, rich, and spooky. And it's also the story, which among other things is about how far an adolescent girl will go to escape being married off to a brute. And let's just say that a childhood home ends up in ashes and it's full of smoldering human bones. Angela Carter's all, yes, yes! When you read the story, it's as if you yourself have fallen under a spell and you've somehow been whisked back to, as Laurel writes in the opening paragraph, long ago in the North Country, where summers are brief and golden, winters long and dark, and the forest deep and wild. But back to what I was saying earlier. Since so many of you already know Laurel and her wicked velvety prose, I think an introduction might not be what we need exactly, so I'm thinking more of what Mark Weingartner often advises us in workshop, how we should take the reader, the audience, back behind the wicked velvet rope. So Laurel's gonna do a way better job of this herself in about 90 seconds, and I'm just gonna warm things up here and get our juices going. And confide to you that among her many other charms and talents, Laurel Lathrop is a goddamn genius when it comes to writing about sex. Because here's the thing, most sex writing goes one of two ways. Either you show the scene right up until the point where things are about to get hot and heavy, and then you kind of do the whole, you know, pan the camera away move. Maybe you add a little space break for privacy. And then you return with, afterward we lay in bed smoking. Or you say, okay, I'm going to dive in, I'm going to do this, yes, 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 and then afterward it just kind of lays there on the page in its own embarrassing damp spot. Laurel, though, so here's an excerpt from her short story titled, Michael Dukakis Tells Us His Plan for America. Her narrator is talking about a guy named Seth. He wasn't my type. His torso was so pale that I could trace the same blue vein from his hip bone to his throat. And his limbs were skinny, with small muscles and thick hair running up his legs and down his arms. The guys I was in law school with were clean-shaven or had carefully trimmed beards, but his extended nearly up to his cheekbones and down to his Adam's apple. His teeth were yellow from cigarettes and coffee, and his nose was speckled with blackheads. His body smelled strongly of wet wool, his thickly furred crotch of sweat. His cock was only average-sized, and none of this mattered because the sex was so good. It had never been so good. I had never thought it could be, and it's never been that good since, not even with my husband, Adam. We have a full, imaginative sex life. He likes to watch me use my vibrator. He likes to have his asshole fingered. We own blindfolds and silk ties and soft floggers. Our sex is a seeding back and forth of control that we both enjoy. But it's nothing like it was with Seth. I fail even now to get a hold on it. It wasn't that no one had dominated me before. As a woman in your early 20s, your sexual world is overflowing with would-be doms, men who want to spank and choke. And it wasn't that he listened to what I wanted, because he didn't, because I lacked the vocabulary to tell him. The closest I can come to pinpointing it is to say he had a kind of improvisatory genius, a bodily intuition that led us, to the right series of movements, different each time, such that by the end I was always dazed and grateful, laughing, exhausted. I was texted a safety word about an hour ago, so I've crossed out a lot of this, but if you want to read more, do approach Laurel later or purchase it when it is inevitably in print for big bucks. We're almost out of time, but one last super quick thing about the brilliance of Laurel's fiction. Recently in Elizabeth Stuckey French's workshop, we were talking about the value of having your character say the hardest thing at some point in the narrative, as Alice Munro does in many of her stories. And as recently as Saturday night, Madame Lathrop was denying up and down that she does this in her fiction and going so far as to claim that she needs to attempt this move. Now, I adore an unreliable narrator as much as the next person, but isn't half the fun figuring out the gap between their spin and the truth? So here is the Monrovian / Lathropian ending of this Michael Dukakis story. I still think sometimes of the night Michael Dukakis failed to appear. I think Seth was right. I did learn something valuable that I am only now trying to put into words, as I see how it has affected and perhaps in some ways determined the arc of my life. I learned what power looks like, and I learned simultaneously that I do not have it. I learned that there are some people whose choices truly matter, who sweep the rest of us along with them, and that the rest of us, no matter how brilliant we are, how superior we believe ourselves to be, how full of scorn, the only choice we truly have is which hand is at our throat. My life has been a matter of choosing the bridle, choosing the bit, choosing what will master me. Laurel Lathrop is a third-year PhD student in fiction at FSU. She's the nonfiction editor of the Southeast Review. Her work has appeared in Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, The Tusk, and Vandal. Give it up, people.
Can you hear me? Do I need to move this? Oh no. Oh God. How about now? Yes? Okay, good. Thank you so much for that introduction, Karen. believe it or not, that's not the end of the sex scene. It sort of goes on, and I freaked out a couple hours ago, and I was like, I don't want them to be thinking about asses while I'm up reading my story. Anyway, thank you so much. That was lovely. All right. I got stuck behind a tow truck on the way here, and then I had to park super far away, and then someone catcalled me as I was walking in. So I came in like boiling with rage, which is of course exactly the mindset you want to be in when you're going to read fiction. So I feel like that introduction was a good sort of calming move. All right, this is a story called Armistice Day. November 11th, 1936. The Gare Montparnasse was gray and chilly and cavernous, lit by yellow globes that left the upper reaches of the ceiling in darkness. My heels clicked on the marble floor. I was late. The train to Mont-Saint-Michel was due to leave in 3 minutes. Cécile and Dorian were waiting for me under a lamp on the central platform that was otherwise empty, looking in their bulky coats like sheep braced against the wind. The train steamed quietly next to them. Salut, mes amis, I said apologetically, untucking my hands from my armpits to embrace first Cécile, then Dorian. Her lips felt like cold water. His cheek was rough and cool as stone. I overslept, I said through chattering teeth. I didn't even have time to make a cup of coffee. You can get coffee on the train, Cécile said with irritation. We always said coffee in English. At the start of the school year, after she'd inexplicably befriended me, the American who'd won a scholarship to spend her senior year of high school at the Lycée Henri IV, we'd negotiated whether the friendship would be conducted in French or English. I was in France to perfect my French and Latin, so I eventually won. But she continued to insist that in some cases, English was simply more vivid. For instance, she'd said across the table from me in the canteen, un café, s'il vous plaît, she said, holding an invisible tiny teacup handle between her first three fingers and tilting it toward her lips, then hunching forward and gripping an invisible mug. "Give me a coffee." "You sound like a Chicago gangster from the movies," I said, smiling. "No one really talks like that." Then she'd called over my shoulder, "Dorian?" And suddenly a long leg was folding over the bench to my right, and a dark head swept past my own, in a little gust of sweet tobacco and hair oil, and just a breath of that unwashed boy masked with cologne smell that I usually couldn't stand. "It's true what they say, the French don't bathe as often as we do," I told my best friend Christine in a postcard. I'd become embarrassed dropping it into one of the thickly painted iron mailboxes that dotted the sidewalk, but I reasoned that the average postman probably couldn't read English. The boy, Dorian, lifted his left leg over the bench to meet the rest of him, and his shoe scraped my shoulder. "Oh, how clumsy, I'm so sorry," he said, turning toward me, and at the first sight of his face, dark lashes and a frowning brow, I felt my heart soften and run like hot wax. "I haven't marked your blouse, at least," he said, rubbing the spot on my shoulder briskly between his fingers. "Dorian, Lenore is an American," Cecile scolded. "You can't molest her with impunity like you can French girls." "That's not what I heard about American girls," he said, leaning in for a moment so our foreheads almost touched. "You'll have to pardon Dorian," Cecile said. "Foreign girls drive him mad with desire. It's his hot Latin blood." I could feel myself blushing as I picked up, then put down my glass of water. "And what do you think I heard about French men?" I managed to say. "That they're repulsive and liars," said Cecile. "And that they should bathe more," I added. Dorian leaned away, laughing, but I thought I'd seen a moment of surprise on his face, and I felt a flush of regret. Then he leaned in for the bisou, the cheek kiss, and I was sure Cecile could see my pulse flutter in my throat. "So you've really never taken a French train before?" Dorian asked as we entered the car and picked our way down the aisle looking for a free compartment. The one nearest the door was occupied by four men, an oddity that drew my attention. It took a moment for me to realize that the jacket sleeve of the man nearest the window was empty, pinned up beneath his shoulder, and that all four, with their prematurely lined faces, were the right age to have been in the war, the age my father would have been. I wondered if there was some arrangement allowing veterans to travel at a reduced fare. I suddenly imagined the whole train full of the men the French cruelly call mutilés. "No," I said, "there's been so much work to do." I regretted how it made me sound, a little mouse locked away in her room. "Studious Lenore," said Cecile behind me. "Don't you know when they give you money to study abroad, they don't actually mean for you to study? Your countrymen are ashamed of you, I'm sure. A real American would have gotten into at least 10 fist fights, contracted syphilis, and been thrown out of restaurants from Marseille to Normandy by now." I laughed, a little stung. I told myself I would travel in the spring, with or without Cecile and Dorian. I imagined myself sitting with a book on a train, moving through fields of lavender, looking out the window at a village prickling with church spires. Eventually, we found an empty compartment and settled down on the vinyl seats. As the train began to move, I unbuttoned my coat and slid my arms out of it. "Keep that close," Dorian nodded at my coat. "The train's warm after sitting in the station, but once we're on our way, you'll see the radiators can't quite keep up." Cecile nestled into her velvet collar. I slid my arms back into my coat sleeves, both for warmth and to make sure the worn silk lining with tears under the arms was hidden. "I'd love to see the countryside in summer," I said. "Yes, you must stay in France once the term ends. You mustn't leave," said Dorian. "Oh, Dorian, as if anyone would stay in gloomy, muggy Paris all summer when she could be seeing all the latest films in Hollywood, where everyone is golden and lovely and everything is new and bright." I'd given up trying to describe my hometown, Santa Clarita, tucked into sleepy foothills and surrounded by apricot orchards, neither Hollywood nor San Francisco. My classmates' reactions last spring when it was announced I was going to Paris had been just as extreme. They'd gasped, murmured about Hemingway and champagne. "Hemingway lives in Key West," I'd said, trying to hide my grin of pride. "But surely," Dorian swept his open hand at the window, "nothing in America can surpass this Parisian glamour." The gray sky was beginning to lighten over the tops of the buildings, freezing rain spattered against the glass, and the leafless trees on the boulevard slid past the windows like lace gloves. "It does rain more than I was expecting," I admitted. "But hardly ever snows," said Cecile, "though personally I'd rather have snow than this slushy stuff. One can wear furs in snow, though when in freezing rain one looks like a wet cat." "And who's been giving you furs, young lady?" asked Dorian. "No one yet," said Cecile, raising and lowering her eyebrows, "but I have great expectations." As we neared the western outskirts of Paris, the buildings got poorer and smaller, the smart slate blue roofs and round gables being replaced with the unfashionably heavy curves of 30 years ago, occasional half-constructed facades languishing under scaffolding. "Look," said Cecile, "in all the excitement of the darling's first train trip, she's forgotten how desperate she was for a coffee." I wouldn't say no to a chocolate, said Dorian. Of course, I said, getting up. I'll bring you one. I meant I'd go with you, he said, scooting across to my seat. We walked down the corridor again, weaving slightly with the motion of the train. The dining car was busy, the booths along the walls occupied by pairs of women smoking, the stools around the bar by men sitting alone. We waited wedged between the bar and the door so that we were jostled each time it opened. When there was finally a space at the bar, Dorian shepherded me in front of him, leaning over me to call the barman, while I tried not to bump into the men sitting on either side. The barman was pouring 3 glasses of red wine. A chocolate and an American coffee, Dorian called. 2 mugs of sludgy brown liquid slid across the bar to us. In my letters home, I often joked about the famous French cuisine, nowhere to be found in the school canteen, though I did appreciate the daily mid-morning snack of warm croissants, or in my boarding house, or in the cheap little bistros we could afford. Mostly, I ate bread and cheese, which were both, in fact, very good. Thanks a million, said Dorian, passing a folded bill over the counter. I invited, I should pay, I protested. Lend me a cigarette instead, he said, his hand on my elbow guiding me to a booth that had just emptied. I passed him one of the mugs, taking a guess at the darker of the 2 liquids. We each took a sip. Mine was gritty, so sweet it hurt my teeth. Dorian was making a similar face. Your coffee, mademoiselle, he said, placing his mug in front of me. I don't understand how you can drink this stuff first thing in the morning, I said, passing him the chocolate. I could say the same for you, he said. Such a bitter drink should sour an empty stomach. I grew up drinking it with my mother, I said. As a kid, I'd take sips of her coffee with my eggs in the morning before leaving for school. She made it with lots of milk, very mild. It was like a little ritual, made me feel grown up. Dorian took a sip of his drink and made another face. That's sweet even for me, he admitted. The little Dorian would have loved it. Do you know the sous-marin? Submarine? I asked in English. Yes, an odd name, he said. It's an Argentinian children's drink, a mug of steamed milk with a cylinder of chocolate alongside. You plunge the chocolate into the milk and stir it until it melts. Or if you're me, you dip it just long enough so it starts to melt and then quickly eat it up before your mother sees. My mother always said French chocolate doesn't melt the right way, but I never noticed. Dorian's mother was an Argentinian who'd married a French Navy captain at the start of the Great War when she was still in her teens. Like my own father, Dorian's father had died in the war before he was born. One of many things I felt tied us together, though we never spoke of it. Now his mother lived off her war widow's pension and taking in sewing from the ladies in the neighborhood. Cécile, Dorian, and I generally went to a cafe or wine bar after school, or sometimes Cécile's apartment, since my boarding house didn't allow male visitors and Dorian's mother was embarrassed of her French. But a few times near the start of the year, he'd invited us over, shrugging, saying his mother wanted to meet the American. Mama, Dorian had said the first time, opening the heavy front door that scraped a little on the tile floor of the hallway. Mama, Cécile had whispered to me as we reached the top of the stairs behind him. Inside the apartment, a little woman in all black, wearing no makeup but dark lipstick, her black hair pinned back, came out of the back room towards us and clasped my arms and kissed my cheeks, 1, 2, 3, 4. She stepped back and looked at my face, beaming. Movie star, she said in English. You have a lovely home, I said, blushing, looking around the dim little living room. She waved away the compliment like a bad smell, and I saw her short, unpainted nails, her reddened hands. We made stilted conversation over tea and little crumbly cakes filled with caramel. Cécile kept trying to catch my eye when Madame Alonso fumbled with her French, Dorian muttering corrections. I tried to ignore them both. My mother works as a teacher, I said, speaking slowly and smiling at her. It's just the two of us as well, I added, gesturing vaguely to her and Dorian. I wasn't sure she understood, but she nodded and gave a stiff smile. There's a great deal of Spanish spoken in California, I said helplessly after a silence, due to the proximity to Mexico. I wish I spoke it. When we left, Dorian had apologized over and over. She's not accustomed to company. Due to the proximity to Mexico, said Cécile. Such a lovely home. Lenore, you put me to shame. Your manners are so gallant. Where's the famous American bluntness, the wise guy? When I got back to my boarding house, I'd lain on the narrow bed and seen the little woman emerging from the back room, her pale, smiling face, her little body trundling toward us in the dimness as though through a tunnel, over and over. Dorian was right. Now that we were out of the city, I could feel the wintry air seeping in around the corners of the windows. In spite of the cold, I leaned close to the glass to watch the train's progress. Say, Lenore, said Dorian in an odd voice, and I turned to face him. He was hunched over his wrists, cupping his mug between his hands. Despite having had more than 2 months to practice composing myself in his presence, I felt little vibrations travel across the table between us like frozen ripples. Yes, I said. He turned his head and looked out the window. It's difficult, he said. That's all right. I heard him breathe in and out once. "It's Cecile," he said. "I'm terribly in love with her. I've loved her since we were children." The popular songs that autumn were all about love that was terrible, love that was tragic, including my favorite one by Lee Gauthier. I heard its lilting strings in my head and the wavering voice of the singer trembling with desire. "She doesn't have many girlfriends," he continued, his face reddening, "but you two have become so close. I was wondering if you could tell me if there's a chance. How does she speak of me when you're alone together?" I can't remember exactly what I told him. It was difficult to speak. Something about how we didn't often talk about boys. This was a lie. She was constantly making conquests. But that if he wanted me to broach the subject, I would try to do it subtly. "God, no," he groaned, putting his face in his hands. "I feel like a coward. Now I've made things awkward for you." "It's all right." I took a gulp of coffee and felt it warm my mouth, my throat. "I'm glad you told me." Dorian reached across the table and put his hand on my wrist and squeezed. His ragged nails bitten down to the quick, the scattering of black hairs on the lowest joint of each of his fingers, his skinny wrists, the slightly dirty cuffs of his green sweater, each detail flooded me with tenderness. "We won't speak of it again, I promise," he said. "Now how about that cigarette?" I was grateful for the chance to turn away and rummage through my bag. He lit both of ours with the heavy gold lighter that had been his father's, exhaled with eyes closed, cleared his throat. "What shall I tell you about the history of Mont Saint-Michel?" "I thought Cecile was the historian," I said. "She is," he said, laughing. "I was going to make it all up. All I know is that it's sometimes an island and it's terribly old. Oh, look!" He pointed out the window. At first, I wasn't sure what he was showing me. The light had changed to a rubbery gray, but no particular detail of the landscape seemed noteworthy. Then I saw something white flutter by the window, moth-like, and then I saw more scattered through the air like bits of paper. "The first snow," he said, "early. It doesn't usually snow till after Christmas, if at all." "Well, it never snows in Santa Clarita," I said. We watched the isolated flakes become flurries whirling by the window. "It's beautiful," I said. "So you've never seen a snowflake up close," Dorian said. I shook my head. "Well, it will certainly stop before we get to the coast, so this is your only chance." He crushed out his cigarette, plucked mine from my hand, and crushed it out as well. "Drink up," he said, "then come with me." In spite of myself, I felt a little thrill. We wove through the dining car, then the next passenger car, both more crowded than I'd expected for such an early train on a holiday. "I thought it was too late in the year for tourists," I said. Dorian looked back at me, puzzled. I gestured around us to the full compartments. He faced forward again and spoke over his shoulder. "These are the people who didn't want to be in the city for all the theatrics, parades and speeches, mass hysterical weeping. Vets and widows, mostly. See all the black?" I was glad he wasn't looking at me. The trip had been Cecile's idea, a whim, I'd thought. A few weeks earlier, as we split a bottle of wine at a cafe, Cecile had said we should take a trip altogether, somewhere spectacular. She'd grown animated describing Mont Saint-Michel for us, a 1,200-year-old abbey 2 kilometers off the shore of Brittany, connected to the mainland only when the tide was out. "They call it La Merveille," she said. "We could go on the 11th. There's no school for Armistice Day, and if we leave before dawn, we can make it a day trip and not have to stay the night. They're quite primitive in Brittany," she'd said confidentially, leaning over the table. "They hate Parisians, and you don't want to know what they say about foreigners." My mother and I had always spent Armistice Day together, quietly. There wasn't any major observance in Santa Clarita. I'd heard it was different in Europe, more funereal, but still I felt foolish for not seeing what Cecile was doing, whisking Dorian away from the pageantry of national mourning, saving him from seeing the city become a gigantic monument to his dead father. I felt I'd missed something about her, something carefully concealed by the pouting and the flirting and the little barbed jokes, but that I should have seen, nevertheless, since we were, after all, alike. We loved the same boy. We'd reached the last car of the train. "What are we doing?" I asked as Dorian pulled me down the aisle toward the door at the end of the car. He said nothing, just opened it, and I braced myself for a rush of wind, some terrible noise. But it was just a little sheltered platform at the back of the train for passengers who needed air or wanted to smoke in peace. "Reach out your hand," Dorian said, his mouth close by my ear, speaking under the noise of the train. We stood at the railing and reached our arms out into the wind, and I saw little soft-edged clusters of snow get caught in the wool fibers of my sleeve. Dorian brought his sleeve up to his face, so I did the same, and for an instant before they melted, I saw the tiny crystalline shapes, some like spoked wheels, some like nettles or the furred legs of insects, all jumbled together against the black sleeve of my coat, like a child's attempt at a starry night. Later, I would live for many years in a place where it snowed each winter, where snow was an inconvenience and a hazard. Even so, I never watched the first snowfall without a moment of wonder, my heart in my throat, thinking of standing at the back of the train to Mont-Saint-Michel, watching the snow swirl over the tracks. When we got back to our compartment, Cecile was slumped against the window. "Where did you two sneak off to?" she asked. "I came to find you in the dining car, and you'd vanished." "Lenore's never seen the snow. We went to catch some snowflakes," said Dorian, folding himself into his seat again. "Oh, and then I suppose you made snow angels and had a snowball fight," Cecile said. "Well, I hope you didn't catch cold. I'd hate to walk all the way to the Abbey with you two sniffling along behind me." "So it's really possible to walk all the way?" I asked. Cecile sat up a little straighter. "Yes, I thought I told you it's only an island at high tide. It'll just be reaching low tide when we arrive at the station. I looked up the tide tables." She had told us this, as well as the fact that the medieval pilgrims who came to the Abbey to worship St. Michael would sometimes get swept away by the incoming tides, which is how the Abbey got its full name, Saint-Michel in Peril of the Sea. But I knew Cecile always felt better when she was the expert, so I settled back in and tried not to think about Dorian telling me he loved her. In my Latin class, which was so much more advanced than the one in California that I was barely passing despite diligent study, we were reading Ovid, and I thought of all the ways he describes of fleeing love. Atalanta, the swift, who beheaded all the suitors who couldn't beat her in a foot race. Daphne, who begged her father, the river god, to transform her into a tree to escape Apollo. Thetis, who changed herself into a serpent, a fire, a lioness, Peleus clinging to her until she was exhausted. I imagined bark growing up around my heart. "Should I have said something?" whispered to Cecile as we walked along the wet sand, Dorian a few steps ahead of us, or as we rode the metro back from the train station late that night, or on New Year's Eve when we all kissed one another because none of us had a lover and it's bad luck to enter the New Year kiss list. If I had, would they have become lovers? Perhaps they did, despite my silence. Perhaps Cecile knew all the time that Dorian loved her and enjoyed making him wait, making him listen to her descriptions of her extravagant flirtations. I was under no illusion that she told me everything in her heart, despite the air she cultivated of divulging the most delicious secrets. Or perhaps it happened after I went back to California, after we said we'd stay in touch but didn't. Perhaps they were lovers when he died. All I know is that 8 years later, in 1944, when I received the only letter Cecile ever sent me, she was unmarried and described Dorian only as our great friend, our dear boy. But she was only 25. There was plenty of time yet. I see her alone when I imagine her, but probably that is my pettiness, wanting her, my cruel friend, to have missed her chance for a great love. I sent her a letter back with sad platitudes and the gesture we both knew to be useless, offering her a place to stay if she were able to come to the United States. I also, and for this I find it hard to forgive myself, I also told her of my engagement. Whether she was hurt by my letter or too grief-stricken to write again, or whether my letter got lost or stolen, or her reply got lost or stolen, or whether she herself was finally caught up in the great machinery whirling around us, I never heard from her again. What can I say about Mont-Saint-Michel? It was beautiful. It's still beautiful. Unlike so many other dimly remembered places, its beauty doesn't depend on its having vanished. It came intact through the centuries, and it came intact through the Second War. We went on a tour that I didn't fully understand, the patter going by quickly, full of architectural and historical terms I didn't know. But I absorbed the tone, regional pride, a faded spiritual reverence. "Never conquered," the tour guide said, a little crooked man in a cap. "The Hundred Years' War, pilgrims still made the journey." I bought postcards in a little shop. I sent one to Christine, one to my mother, kept the others for myself. I still have them, tucked away with Cecile's letter. I have since looked in guidebooks and been appropriately amazed at how the Abbey was carved from the rock over the centuries. I must have been amazed at the time as well, but it's muted now by all that came after. What I remember, the first sight of it from the window of the train as we sped through the rocky meadows along the coast, how it seemed to have broken off from some wondrous country, floated across the sea toward us to sit beached on the sands. The pale blue of the sky, the russet of the dead fields, the yellowish cream of the Abbey's stone like scalded milk, and how it seemed to wait for us alone as we picked our way toward it, the wet sand sucking at our shoes, the salt air whipping our hair across our faces. Two girls and a boy walking the shimmering sands on Armistice Day, 2 years before the war. Thank you.